Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, VESA HDR 1000 G-Sync at a $2,000 price tag. Let's talk about Asus's latest gaming monitor. Micron's rolling GDDR6 memory. WPA3 certification means better security for Wi-Fi. And yes, Apple and Samsung have settled that seven-year-old lawsuit. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 472, recorded on June 28th, 2018. HDR for the desktop, it's getting real, people.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Take back your internet privacy today. For 3 months free with a one-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twitch.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch's weekly show that aims to bring you the most engaging, most delightful, most informative, most informed, and occasionally slightly irritated and downright cranky hardware news and reviews. We talk about desktop, laptop, mobile, the Internet of Stuff, consoles. And last week was crazy as Intel brought on a search for new leadership. You were not available. You were getting your basketball on last week, Mr. Ryan Shrout. I'm Patrick Norton, by the way. He's Ryan Shrout. What was the draft like? I got to ask.
I went to the NBA draft last week. It was really interesting. Part of a charity event that I had taken part in last year. Actually, last August, signed up for it. And, you know, you kind of lose track of time. And suddenly it's like, oh, it's June. It's that time. It's a really interesting environment. It's very different than watching it on TV. And like most sporting events, you get more up-to-date information and newer information on TV than you do inside, the arena. In a seat, but
so it's like the exact opposite of most of press day at CES.
yes, correct. Now I will say, the Intel CEO firing news hit me while I was flying on the way to New York, and while I had planned an entire afternoon of kind of wandering around and meeting up with some people. Instead, I wrote two articles and did two phone interviews on what the impact on Intel and the rest of the technology field was going to be after Brian Krzanich's departure. And then, so it turned it into a full workday. So it was clearly big news.
Big news. Our thought was like, this seems like a convenient reason to have him go away. I mean, it's nice that the rules apply to Intel, everyone at Intel equally, but this seemed like something where Intel had a happy opportunity to make massive changes in leadership. Was that your kind of summary on that, or?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. BK been universally loved by the community and investors, I think this would have been something that they would have gone through some sensitivity training for. Mm-hmm. And this was in the past and it's been resolved now. This is a private family matter, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, when it's like, well, as it turns out, we weren't really getting along anyway. So this is a good excuse to move on. And now, it's been a week and we still don't know who the replacement is and what the timetable is for finding a replacement. So it'll be really interesting to see what shifts for Intel moving forward after they find that new CEO.
As we are fond of saying on This Week in Computer Hardware, we wait with bated breath.
Yeah.
Apparently, however, we no longer have to wait for HDR on the desktop. True HDR arrives on the desktop. Now, I've looked at some Dell monitors that have VESA 400 certification. VESA 1000 certification seems to be the goal for a lot of people for declaring HDR on the desktop. I won't even get into the miasma of pain and suffering that HDR supports in gaming and content seems to be on the desktop. Mm-hmm. Outside of this having an even more marvelous and strange base than your average Alienware monitor, or at least, if nothing else, a more compact base than an Alienware monitor. What makes you think that true HDR has finally arrived on the desktop?
Well, first of all, we do hit that Display HDR 1000 certification on this display. Boom. Right? So that to me is interesting because we've now looked at Display HDR 400. We've had some Display HDR 600 monitors here. But we also have, we've had the LG OLED screens here, the Samsung screens here that do HDR, the TVs, I should say. And the difference in kind of the immediate wow factor of looking at it and knowing something is different on the TVs was there, whereas on the monitors we had seen up until this one were that factor was missing, right? It had better color, larger color space. It was a better monitor than in terms of color reproduction than most other monitors we had seen, this first wave of HDR. But I didn't walk away from it impressed, right? And kind of going, wow, that looks a lot better than what we were used to. And, you know, we'll get into the $2,000 price tag that this monitor has, but as soon as you see a game running in HDR, you see video running in HDR on this monitor, you get that wow factor. And it's because of that 1,000 nits, you know, peak brightness, and the sustained 600 nits brightness, that is part of that Display HDR 1000 spec. And it just stands out. And it's one of those things we've talked about, 3D and variable refresh and all these display technologies that you cannot show people unless they see it in person. I can't show you an image or a video or a clip or an animated GIF to make HDR look like it's going to look. And in fact, we found out like taking HDR screenshots of a game is actually really complicated because even NVIDIA's GeForce Experience keeps them in the HDR color space. When you view them on a standard def monitor, they just look washed out, right? So the pictures you see in our article there are actually taken with a phone, you know, looking at the screen itself, which is probably the best thing we can, best analogy we could come to. In terms of the hardware itself, I will say, again, for a $2,000 monitor, the build quality just seems okay. It doesn't look like a $2,000 monitor. It looks very much like the rest of the ROG line. Ken even commented he thinks it looks less interesting than some of the other ROG line of displays. It's got a thicker bezel. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit wider, thicker of a device. And you're looking at pictures there now where Ken dissected it and found the control board for it. And what you see there is a rather beefy heatsink and fan combination that is cooling an Altera FPGA and 3 gigabytes of memory on that G-Sync HDR module. If you go down to the next picture, you can see the FPGA in its entirety. Yeah, there it is. It's not a small chip. It's an expensive part. There is some debate on how expensive. If you look up that specific Altera FPGA on, you know, like a retail establishment like Mouser or something like that, it's like $2,500 or something like that. Clearly, NVIDIA is not paying that. But it's 3 gigs of DDR4 memory on there as well, up from the 768 megabytes of memory that the original G-Sync modules use. So there's a lot of cost in there. We kind of initially were estimating it somewhere around $500, maybe. That's just kind of a guess. The more I'm hearing, it's maybe a little bit less than that, maybe closer to $300 for that module.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot for a processing chip on a display. It does have RGB LED ROG logo on the back. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of acronyms I just said, but it does have them. It's got something where it will project the ROG logo on the desk in front of you or on the wall behind you. You know, if that's something you're interested in doing. The OSD is really nice. It navigates quickly. It's easy to find what you're looking for. There were some reports. There was like a video going around on YouTube of the Acer G-Sync HDR monitor that is using a similar panel to this, where they were talking about the fan in it being very loud.
Right.
That was because they had VESA mounted it. And the way Acer designed the chassis is that when you VESA mounted that monitor, it kind of blocked the air intake for the monitor, which is not something people have normally had to think about. So it's right. You can kind of understand why somebody would miss that. The Asus one here has offsets or standoffs rather, so that there remains space behind that. You know, the fan, if you put your ear on the other side of the monitor and listen for it, you could hear the fan, but it was not loud. It was not something that I would consider, you know, obnoxious or anything like that. Yeah, you can see the fan kind of through the casing right there. So it is kind of odd to have an actively cooled monitor, but there you go.
Stranger things will have happened.
Yeah. Gaming impressions were awesome. I don't want to spend too much time on this. We played Destiny 2, we played Far Cry 5, we played Assassin's Creed Origin, we played Hitman. All these games have HDR support of some kind. There's still a pretty wide variance of what the settings are for each of these. You know, Far Cry 5, I think it was, for example, that had a really good, you could set the minimum paper white and then the maximum brightness of the display, right? And you set those two data, those two points, and then it did all the mapping in between. I think Destiny 2 just basically had like an on-off option. Assassin's Creed Origin had an on and a minimum, right? Like trying to set the minimum paper white or something like that. So, and not all games support HDR, and some games support it better than others. So there's still some variance there, but it's way better than I expected it to be at this point in terms of, you know, we're playing the Alpha Battlefield 5 came out. HDR works on that. It looks fantastic. It's great. And this is a 384 zone dimming, like 384 dimmable zones, I guess. So you get a lot of granularity to the HDR effect. It just looks great, and much better than I would say than any other HDR gaming monitor, any HDR monitor we've actually had in here yet. Plus, it's still G-Sync, right? I haven't even mentioned that part. It's still a variable refresh monitor using this 4K up to 144 hertz, but there's some... You can only run at 98 hertz if you want 10-bit color. If you're willing to go down to 8-bit color, you can hit 144 and it's overclocked state. So there's some data rate issues there for DisplayPort. I will say at 4K, the chances of you going over 98 frames per second is pretty low, right? Mm-hmm. So being able to run in G-Sync mode up to 98 hertz, I still think is really, really good for 4K, especially when you get the HDR in there and everything. So I came away really impressed with it. And, you know, the things I would change would be, it's a 27-inch 4K monitor. I'd rather it be like a 32-inch monitor just because of that resolution. And then also that price. The price of $2,000 is kind of a lot to swallow.
It's not inexpensive to hit that VESA 1000 certification. The brightness alone requires a fair amount of it's just, there's a lot of money that goes into getting a screen that bright, especially if color consistency is an issue for you. You know, to put that in perspective, Dell's UltraSharp 27, which is their VESA 1000 rated, I want to say, or the equivalent of, I don't know if they did VESA ratings, but essentially it has most of the specs, I think. You know, is not including any of the gaming features. So there's no G-Sync on that. It's a 60 hertz monitor. But, you know, the MSRP is, you know, $1,999.99, and it sells for $1,550. You know, I also want to say is, you know, we may kind of poo-poo on the Display HDR 400 spec, but when I was looking at the Dell's 27-inch ultra-thin monitor, the S2718D back in April, one, the color was really fantastic. Two, it actually, despite having a lower certification than you would expect, you know, you're talking about a desktop monitor that has a wider color gamut than almost the vast majority of 4K HDR TVs that were sold in the living room in 2017, and probably comparable and in some cases better brightness numbers than a lot of living room TVs. And the monitor is sitting sitting a couple feet in front of you, not 12 feet or 8 feet away from you. So the upside is, even with the lower VESA certifications, is you're probably looking at brighter lighting. You're just not getting the full contrast. And, you know, the advantage to OLED is it doesn't have to hit the same number of nits for a full HDR you know, for sort of to deliver the same HDR experience, you kind of need a brighter LED or an LCD, or you need an OLED where it goes, the blacks are more true or darker. There's a higher, yeah. You know, the it's more about the contrast than the actual nit level, but, it's, if you've been waiting to buy a monitor, I feel like, you know, this next year is going to be looking really good. And I think next year is going to be even better. I'm also really curious, you know, tweet at Patrick Norton or at Ryan Trout, if you're thinking about buying a new monitor, because one of the things we see, you know, I think our audience probably buys bigger monitors earlier than the average person, but it always amazes me to realize what a tiny percentage of, consumers on Steam, it's like single digits for monitors bigger than 1080p, and the next largest monitor size after 1080p gaming monitor, just regular 1080p monitors on Steam, is actually a lower resolution, kind of a mock 720p panel size that we saw for a long time before 1080p became affordable. Curious. I also will say, you know, if you've been using your monitor for 5 years or more, putting it next to a brand new monitor will suddenly have you believing in the sort of, you know, decay rate on the backlighting.
Yeah, that's really likely. My kind of final takeaway on this monitor is really, it's clearly the best gaming monitor that you can buy, but it's really hard to recommend at $2,000. You know, you have to know your budget and know that you can afford it. This is the kind of person, if you don't have a 1080 Ti or a Titan XP, this is not the right monitor for you. Just both because of the price range and because of the resolution and refresh rates that you're going to be wanting to hit with it. So, you know, I wouldn't buy this and say, oh, buy this and now you're future-proofed, ready for HDR. There's going to be improvements. There's going to be, you know, price reductions as the months and quarters go by.
There's going to be more
competition. Unless you plan on utilizing it now. Yeah, there will be.
The reason VESA put a spec together is because they expect a lot of competition in this area. And also understand that in many cases, you may not be able to get the settings you want to deliver the frame rates you want without spending more on GPUs than you want to spend. The Qualcomm SDM1000, I like WinFuture's, Grosse Arm chip for Windows 10 PCs. For any Germans in the audience, I'd like to apologize for my magnificently awful German accent. Das der US chip Verstelle Qualcomm zusammen mit Microsoft in einer neuen Plattform für deutlich leistungsfähiger Notebooks und 2 und 1 Tablet. In any case,
you could more hit details the translate are leaking. Button.
I could, but what joy is there in that? essentially, is the Windows. Everybody thinks that we're finally starting to get some details leaked on what exactly is going on with the Qualcomm's dedicated ARM processor for Windows 10 TVs, Windows 10 laptops, the SDM1000. Any surprises there outside of, you know, the Germans getting the information first? Not that they don't.
No, not in particular. Well, so here's the thing. Qualcomm's announced the Snapdragon 850, but it's not shipping yet. So we assume that this is a mid-2019 kind of release, if not later, you know, maybe holiday 2019 release. There's no details on what the clock speeds are, what the core counts are. But they do talk about it being a higher TDP, going from like 6 watts to 12 watts peak TDP. All the good money bet is on this being based on the Cortex A76, which is the new core IP that ARM just announced last month that promises Skylake level IPC within 10% of Skylake level IPC while being die size equivalent of fitting inside just the cache for a Skylake core. These are really impressive claims, especially considering they're also say that they're not losing any of their power efficiency, that give them the battery life advantages and the always on advantages. If they can do that, then, you know, if you're Qualcomm and you've got a little bit more die space to work with, because now you're working at 7 nanometers and Intel may still be at 14 nanometer, likely will still be at 14 nanometer at that point, then maybe you power 8 cores on there, 4 big, 4 little or something. And you've got, now you're not, now the Windows 10 on Snapdragon argument is not about, well, okay, if you don't care about performance in these areas, you can do that, to the performance is there. Now it's everything else that goes along with it. And that would be a pretty big story for Qualcomm if they can pull it off. Apparently the demo system or the development system that was the source of these leaks had, 16 gigs of LPDDR4 memory. It was still using UFS, but UFS 2.1. It was using 228 gig modules connected to UFS 2.1. Gigabit Ethernet or gigabit Wi-Fi, gigabit LTE or higher type speeds. There's some stuff in this story about it maybe being a socketed chip, and I find that to be impossible. I think maybe in the development phase, it might be socketed, but for super thin lights, that's just not going to happen.
There was a sort of a long digression in that article, which is much more engaging for me translated into English, which was basically talking about how huge the chip is, but talking about the socket. And the socket reeks of, we don't know what we're going to do to this. We don't know if we're going to make major changes to this, and you're not going to rebuild your motherboard. So, let's create a, let's create a socket for this temporarily. I don't see any possible universe where they have a socketed chip on a mobile device like this. I thought it was great, the idea of the developer platform has like 16 gigs of DDR4 RAM on board. The idea that these could be fairly powerful systems. I'm curious, I'm also curious to see, what the difference, I'm curious for myself to see the real world difference between, running a universal app on an ARM device versus an Intel device. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I thought it was interesting. You picked an article, Corsair is expanding, as they kind of seem to always be doing. They bought Elgato, which most of the universe knows is a company that did Mac-only TV tuners and video capture devices. If you haven't heard about Elgato in a while, they've been doing streaming, targeting streaming at gamers. And I was having this moment where I was trying to decide, wait, is this streaming your games on your gaming system to your, portable devices in your house? Or is this capturing game streams to broadcast on your Twitch channel?
It's the latter.
Okay.
Yeah, the Elgato gaming brand is basically, it's capture cards, PCIe add-in or external or what have you, that allow you to capture your console output or your PC output, send it out to Skype, do your overlays, have some interesting software added onto it. And so Corsair bought that division of it. The rest of Elgato that kind of did the IoT stuff and whatnot remains. It's separating it out of its own independent brand. But yeah, in terms of Corsair just constantly getting into new areas, and they've bought some companies to do it recently. Elgato, they just showed the little, like, keypad type thing, the touchpad interface where you can create custom icons to do all that. It's a really interesting ecosystem of stuff, and that kind of video there shows you what that looks like with Corsair and Elgato in the mix. I mean, this helps Corsair in a couple of ways that gets them their foot in the door on the console side, because a lot of console gamers will stream console gaming through Elgato hardware. So that's a good entryway for them for something that Corsair has kind of been lacking. If you look at something like Kingston, they've been very big in the console space. Corsair has had more limited interaction there. So these are both private companies, so no idea how much they paid or anything like that or what the terms were. But I'm sure it was for a decent amount of money. But
one would hope for Elgato's sake.
Did you see there was a second picture I posted in there about the Elgato team joked about prototyping. Yeah. Prototyping a new version of the 4K60 to go more in line with some of the trends that Corsair's been on. So RGB illuminated capture cards, which is ironic because one of Elgato's competitors, Avermedia, released, I think they announced a card this week that does in fact have RGB LEDs integrated into it. So we're probably not that far behind.
I'm not going to say I'm waiting with bated breath for that one.
Fair. That's fair.
It's obvious why you would use this to capture HDMI off of a console. Is this something that's going to, you know, increase your gaming performance if you are using this instead of, say, the software built into the G-Sync experience to stream your gaming?
There's two minds of that. There are some mm-hmm. people that will use GFE or something locally, but that tends to takes some semblance of performance away from your machine. It's also less flexible. You don't have as much customization you can do if you're just streaming through GFE. GFE's gotten better. You can, you know, add in your webcam and that kind of thing. But if you want to integrate chat, you want to integrate some more customized Twitch features, external software, external systems are the way to go, right? So you'd have your game mm-hmm. PC, and then you'd have the capture PC, and that's kind of the avenue there. So I think that's still a really sizable market for Elgato and the competing products out there.
Cool. I've been doing a lot of network testing lately, a lot of which has involved at least one product that maybe wasn't ready for prime time when the company released it. Although it turns out that sometimes it's your ISP, sometimes it's the networking product, and sometimes it's everything. But I thought it was interesting that WPA3 certification started this week, which is essentially a lot of these technologies have been out, but this is big primarily for the Wi-Fi security. There's any of a number of summaries on this online, but you know, the Wi-Fi Alliance is finally updating WPA2, and which has been desperately, desperately needed. And one of the things to think about, you know, it's going to help deliver a more secure environment, even if the passwords chosen by end users are terrible. You know, so it looks like simultaneous authentication of equals for the handshake, which would mean if it is implemented the way people think it is, dictionary attacks wouldn't work. The individualized data encryption, some other stuff that will essentially vastly upgrade, at least until the flaws are found, security for home routers. This is certification is just beginning. Don't expect any of this to be rolling out to your home network in the immediate future. You know, but I'm kind of curious. I mean, in theory, they might be available in late 2018, and I haven't gotten what I consider to be a particularly stellar answer on whether or not existing WPA2 client devices, i.e. the network adapter in your laptop, are going to work properly with this. So either I'm not reading the press releases right, or the answer is a little more obscure than I would like it to be. I'm going to get a little deeper in on this and get a more definitive answer on that, because I think better network security is something that we all want. It would be nice, I would expect it to take years, just like every other Wi-Fi upgrade is taken. To be honest with you, I'll put it this way. I'm 98% sure that along with a new router, you're also going to have to upgrade your devices to get full WPA3 support. WPA3 will be backwards compatible with WPA2. Dictionary attacks, password guessing attacks should be beaten down in a pretty significant way. So
good.
I like that idea. So, there's also, the difference between theory and practice and, the product being in a lab and being in the open universe. But in theory, the way the encryption is working, you should only be able to make a single guess, which would mean you would have to be physically present to actually to work cracking on the stream. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I would like to see more security on wireless devices. If you're feeling me sounding a little less than fully invested. It's because it seems like every time we come up with something that's unbreakable, several minutes after it's released, it becomes breakable. In something you probably forgot about if you're a normal human being, this just makes me laugh. Apple and Samsung have settled their 7-year-long patent fight over copying the iPhone. Whether or not that's related to LG taking on Apple taking on LG as a second source of OLED screens for mobile devices or something else. But The Verge says Judge Lucy Koh said the two companies had informed her that they had reached a settlement. Terms of the settlement were not disclosed. This started in 2011. There was a $1 billion ruling in Apple's favor. You know, the series of appeals basically went to the Supreme Court. You know, the companies were going back and forth over what patents were infringed, how much Samsung owes Apple because of the infringement. You know, and a lot of stuff like a home screen app grid, tap to zoom, you know, the jury basically came to the conclusion that Samsung had copied Apple back in the dark ages of cell phones and were whacking them down. The last sort of public number we got for the settlement was like $539 million. You know, whether or not they paid that. I can't even imagine what the legal fees on something like this would be. But
over 7 years as well.
Pretty staggering. The other thing that, that came up in the world of courts is the Facebook payout and the Oculus copyright feud is down to $250 million. The jury Facebook won a, I'm going to quote Bloomberg, Facebook won a ruling that halved the jury's $500 million verdict against its Oculus unit for using computer code in its virtual reality headset that was taken from another company.
If you remember, this is ZeniMax, which is where John Carmack came from. Yeah.
So ZeniMax was trying to ban, to get the judge to ban the sales of Oculus headsets. So this is...
It fell from their original lawsuit amount of $2 billion to being awarded $500 to now it's been down. It's been pushed down to $250 million. Still pretty good, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think ZeniMax still maintains that they would be Oculus and be worth the $2 billion that Facebook paid for Oculus, if only. You know, we'll see. You know, the people, you can litigate for a long time if you're angry enough and you don't run out of money.
I like this part of the Bloomberg story. ZeniMax said it's pleased to have won $250 million plus $54 million in interest and disappointed the jury verdict was cut in half. They got $54 million in interest on that. So,
you know, you could do worse.
Yeah,
there's a lot of companies that would be really happy with that. $304 million.
I'm one of them.
Oh, my goodness. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. We talk about data hacks and breaches on the show. If you follow anything, if you are aware of tech news, or maybe barely aware of tech news, or maybe you're just trying to upgrade the level of security in your life, a VPN is a nice thing to do because it helps protect your privacy. Doesn't matter what you do online, your mobile carrier, your ISP, they know everything you're doing. Every website you visit, every email you send, because it's all done out in the open and they pay attention. Everybody pays attention. Oh my goodness, you would not believe how many companies out there pay attention to what you do online. Which is why I use a VPN. And I'm currently, thanks to their sponsorship of This Week in Computer Hardware, using ExpressVPN. I very rarely use the internet without a VPN. ExpressVPN, the world's leading VPN provider, lets you securely use the internet without being tracked by anyone. Keeps your online activity private and anonymous while you browse, email, download, and stream. And it's great for streaming content. You can even use it to watch the World Cup without a cable subscription. You know, because you get 148 cities in 94 countries with unlimited speeds and unlimited server switches, which means you can go to the country you need. My classic case, I will admit, would not be World Cup soccer, but would be actually curling in Canada. I actually first started using a VPN, not for security, not for privacy, not because I was afraid of having people tap into what I was doing at the coffee shop, but because I could not stream curling from Canada without pretending I was at a Canadian IP address. It's an easy-to-use app. It encrypts all your internet data, hides your IP address, protects the entire connection, whether you're in a coffee shop, a hotel, or you're just at home and don't want to share what you're doing with your ISP. ExpressVPN costs less than $7 a month, runs seamlessly in the background of your computer, your phone, or your tablet. And every time you use the internet without ExpressVPN, you're putting your sensitive data at risk. Take back your internet privacy today, people, and find out how you can get 3 months free with a one-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/twitch to learn more. And we want to thank expressvpn.com/twitch for their sponsorship of This Week in Computer Hardware. Do you currently run... have you been running a VPN, or do you just let your packets get sniffed where they may, sir?
I definitely don't do that. I will say that if I'm home, I don't, but I travel a lot, and so VPNs get used pretty often for that. Anytime I'm connecting to a hotel Wi-Fi or even really on the airplane Wi-Fi, I will do that as well. Yeah.
It's
a good idea.
It's amazing. If you haven't used a VPN in a long time, for example, because the last time you used a VPN, your internet slowed down considerably, give ExpressVPN a try. You might be pleasantly surprised by how VPN performance has increased in the last few years. Things I didn't expect to be reading this week, Volume 17, Micron announces GDDR. There's a sentence in here, yearning to breathe free. Micron announces GDDR6 production is in full swing. It's just, you know, I just didn't expect GDDR6 production to start anytime soon. But that may be because they're trying to keep ahead of all of the piracy going on in Taiwan and China of RAM production. Not that I'm snarking.
The Micron's announcement is second to Samsung. Samsung announced that they were going to have GDDR6 ICs. They announced it back in January that they were going to start mass production, but they haven't talked really about what the ramp is on that. Microsoft did the same thing. Micron is saying that the production is in a full throughput, and the assumption here is that in whatever NVIDIA is building, its next-gen cards are going to have GDDR6 memory on them because HBM is still too expensive, not seeing the advantages of integration that people had thought. GDDR6 will be significantly faster than GDDR5 while being less expensive in theory, right? So I wouldn't expect GDDR6 to come out like if NVIDIA's next family of graphics cards comes out all at once, or even if it comes out gradually, I don't expect them all to use G6. I would expect really only the top SKUs to use G6 and then the rest to use G5, maybe G5X for their graphics memory. But now that we have Samsung on board, we have Micron on board, it's not a coincidence that they would have, you know, a big customer already lined up for some of this.
Oh my goodness. You know, and I also got to say I giggle looking at the graphic that Micron sent out, which is kind of reminds me of any of a number of NVIDIA announcements over the last few years. What is it best for? Autonomous driving, crypto mining, artificial intelligence.
All the things you think of.
All the things that memory uses. So I just had to make that gentle snark before I went. Threadripper 2990X rumors come with good and bad news. Hit me.
Well,
sorry, that was the shortest transition I've made in a while.
The good news is high court counts. The bad news is, Jeremy posted it as bad news, but it all comes down to your comparison here of about, I think they're saying the 2900X was listed for sale at around $1,750 or 1,500 euros, which translates into 1,750 US dollars. I think in general, what happens is if it launches for 1,500 euros, it launches for $1,500 in the US, give or take. Which kind of puts an interesting question out there. If that were the case, I have no idea one way or the other if that's the case, what the pricing is going to be on this. But they've announced a 32-core part, and a 32-core part's going to be out late in the summer. Is $1,500 too much for that?
Probably not to the people who are buying these. Probably sounds really irritating if you were hoping to buy a Threadripper and wanted the latest generation. I feel compared to Intel's pricing for similar parts, it's pretty reasonable. But
I mean, if you look at their 18-core processor, the 7980XE Intel's, it's $2,000. So they were already priced well above that. And I think the 16-core Threadripper is like, you can, it's MSRP is $999, but you can usually find it for sale for around like $950, maybe $899 every once in a while.
I think I can, I'm not buying a Threadripper anytime soon because the 1800X is fulfilling my needs quite adequately. But man, I feel like for me, next year is going to be, Threadripper is just more processor than I need for the vast majority of what I do. But if you need all the cores, I just love what AMD's doing. Yeah. 32 cores.
I think anybody who was hoping that they were going to release a 32-core part for the same $999 MSRP is going to be sorely disappointed because it's just they're using like the fundamentals of the design aren't changing. They're still using the same die essentially, right? So they're going to need four die on that 32-core part instead of two. It's impossible. Nothing has changed in the last year where suddenly the process technology is more advanced or something like that. So, $1,500 I think is probably about right for it. If they wanted to be super aggressive, maybe make it $1,299 or something like that. Hopefully it won't be long before we find an answer because they have committed to Q3, I think, for that launch of the Threadripper 2000 series.
Goodness. It's been a while since we've seen a Qualcomm chipset, basically for Android Wear. But I thought it was interesting that Qualcomm has released the Snapdragon Wear 2500 platform, quote, to help companies build watches for children. Nice write-up on CNET on that one. I just thought that was kind of, their theory is that the kids with the parents that are the nervous need the smartwatch and smartwatches for kids. And having seen a couple of mobile devices or essentially wristwatches that are designed to allow kids to communicate with their parents and not have 24/7 access to, Minecraft, for example, which would probably destroy my children. They see these tiny watches basically, 4G LTE connectivity with a basic processor I think they see a niche that isn't owned entirely by Apple at this point or isn't dominated by Apple. And I'm kind of very curious to see how that goes because, the numbers that are seen at quotes that Shar Tipkin quotes in the article is that Apple currently owns like 31% of the smartwatch market, or at least did in 2017. So, it's interesting. And as a parent, I'm curious to see what comes out because, a lot of the child tracking devices I've seen over the years are easily spoofable or completely worthless. Mm-hmm. If you say walk inside of a mall, the wireless radio, I'm curious. I think it's an interesting move for Qualcomm, but I also feel like Qualcomm's advancing in every direction simultaneously because they also announced, the Snapdragon 632, 439, and 429, which are their mid-level mobile parts, which are essentially like the old ones, but a little bit faster and a little bit better, but not quite as good as the 845. You know, and meanwhile, you've got stuff like there's a great TechCrunch write-up on Instagram Lite. And the whole point of Instagram Lite is dealing with the fact that there are so many Android devices around the world that don't have a lot of storage and don't have a lot of memory. And it's kind of crazy. 573 kilobytes Instagram Lite is 155th the size of Instagram's 32 megabyte main app. So John Constein wrote that up for TechCrunch. And I just thought, like, you know, Facebook, you know, did a light version of Facebook. They did a light version of Messenger in 2018. Apparently Uber has its own light app. So it's, you know, it's curious to watch. You know, Instagram's already grown to 1 billion active users worldwide monthly, and now they're trying to figure out how to make the product even more accessible around the world. I'm curious. I mean, that's you know, we talk about, like, well, you know, this application would work better if it was, you know, better tuned. And, you know, I'm curious to, you know, to see some of the differences between the light app versus the heavy app in terms of the experience and how people do or do not enjoy using it. But that's a pretty significant change in, you know, the amount of data you have to download. And I'm kind of curious what it does to the actual photos and videos that run through that. I just thought that was an interesting, you know, because we often talk about flagships, but we often don't talk about keeping your older devices functioning as apps get heavier and heavier. But
yeah.
Oh my goodness! With that, ladies and gentlemen, you have an event to depart for that will remain secret.
Sure, that's fine.
Involving family.
Yeah.
But what's anything you can tease that's going on at PC Per this week?
Ken sent his own dollars to a place in China to have them make one of those custom Lenovos. Have you ever seen any of these with the custom Lenovo, kind of like the X201 style chassis, but now it has an eighth generation Intel platform in there. So far, mixed bag of results on that one in terms of, hey, maybe it doesn't have take advantage of all the power techniques, power saving and efficiency techniques. So, it may not turn out to have been his best investment, but we'll find a little bit more about that next week.
The X201, how old is an X201 at this point?
Like 2006, okay. I think. Yeah. I mean, it's the classic. It's the classic world's favorite keyboard. It's got the nubbin in the middle, but it's got the two sets of buttons on the trackpad, the two buttons above it and the two buttons below it, just depending on, you know, if you're using a trackpad or the red nub. It's got that 9-cell battery where part of it sticks out the back of the machine. Classic Lenovo. These are the ThinkPads that I used for the better part of a decade, you know, generation after generation, 200, 201, you know, all the way up through. But this one is branded the ThinkPad X10, which apparently never actually existed. So this is the brand that these guys have gone with for these custom builds. It's pretty interesting.
I'd like to point out that the nubbin is called a track point in the ThinkPad vernacular.
Yeah, but it's really just a nubbin.
It's a pointing stick, man. Oh my goodness. We're talking about running dual booting Linux and Windows on a system. And one of the things we completely forgot when we were answering that question last week on Tech Thing was VMware and VirtualBox. We spent a little bit of time talking about that this week, but we spent a whole bunch of time talking about Windows antivirus options and how to get them for less money if you don't feel that Windows Defender is enough for you. And we got hands-on with a Fire TV Cube. Shannon bought one. And it is a curious device, essentially the unholy, I won't say that. That's kind of rude. It is essentially the offspring of an Amazon Echo and an Amazon Fire TV with a whole lot of IR blasters and a few buttons on the top. I will say this. If you like a volume control on your remote, you're going to be really irritated. And if you want to control everything with your voice, you'll be a lot more satisfied and shockingly, the voice control works a lot better within the Fire TV than it does with all of the devices you could attach to your Fire TV. So, you know, if you're thinking of it as being a Harmony remote replacement, as soon as you get out of the Fire TV environment, you're going to be reaching for a remote to do a lot of things, which
maybe
something attachable and firmware. I think the biggest thing was performance was not spectacular. So, you know, in terms of changing between devices was, in Shannon's opinion, my words, not hers, her emotions, not mine, heinously, upsettingly, terribly, awfully long, which is how I felt about certain moments using the Kavo as a unit.
Okay.
So something to think about on Tech Thing this week. And we've also been looking at a bunch of the sub $1,000 gaming laptops, which shockingly are great for 1080p.
Shockingly.
1050 Ti and a Core i5, 1080p gaming is actually pretty affordable.
You can do it.
Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. For more Ryan Shrout, go to PCPro.com or at Ryan Shrout. You can find more of me over at Tech Thing or the Home Theater and Audio Podcast. I do AV Excel, and I'm at Patrick Norton on the Twitters. And we do this podcast each and every week, except when terrible things happen like national holidays and we can't record. So do yourself a favor. If this is your first episode, go to twit.tv/Twitch and go check out all our older episodes. Get all the information on how to subscribe. And seriously, thank each and every one of you for listening. There's no point in us doing this if you're not going to listen. So the fact that you're there makes it pretty awesome. With that, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.